The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Israeli music legend David Broza, singer, guitarist, and songwriter. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, visiting correspondent Rabbi David Wilfond, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking about earthquakes lately. It's hard to miss them on the news the last couple of months with the horrific and disastrous earthquake in Haiti on January 12th that killed nearly 100,000 people and just about destroyed the infrastructure of that poverty-stricken country. And then this week's awful 8.8 Richter scale quake in Chile, which killed perhaps 1,000 people in that much more developed and functional country, but still wrought tremendous destruction. Natural disasters, floods, tsunamis, volcanic explosions, drought, fires, avalanches, blizzards, and the like all cause havoc in human lives and remind us of our fundamental fragility. We all feel, to one degree or another, in control of our own lives. But when confronted with natural disasters, we come face to face with the fact that we just aren't really in control at all. Earthquakes, however, seem to me to be materially different. These other disasters come from natural elements we are kind of used to. But when you're standing on solid ground and it suddenly begins to shake, you quickly develop an appreciation for the fact that what you thought was sound and dependable just isn't. I speak from some experience in this matter, having grown up in the earthquake capital of America, Los Angeles, California, and having known nearly since infancy just what to do when the ground begins to shake. In fact, I always knew the ground could move beneath my feet at any time, and that it was really no big deal. I vividly recall sitting at Shabbat dinner at my parents' home and frequently watching the chandelier swing back and forth, and realizing it was another little earthquake. No problem. And then, one morning in February of 1971, I awakened to find my bed, which had those little wheels on it, rolling back and forth in a wide arc across the floor, lights flashing on and off wildly, and my dad suddenly standing in the doorway, urging my brother and me to get up and out because we were having an earthquake. No kidding. It was the most powerful physical experience I've ever had. And now, having been through car accidents, river rafting, flips, surfing disasters, tackle football, skiing crashes, and a variety of other concussive experiences, that is still far and away the most powerful and overwhelming physical experience I've ever had. And that was an earthquake measuring 6.6 on the Richter scale. The Richter scale, by the way, is exponential. Every point is roughly 10 times more than the last one. So a 7 is 10 times more intense than a 6. Well, mine in L.A. was 6.6 on the Richter scale. The one in Chile this week measured an astonishing 8.8, roughly 100 times as intense as the one I lived through, which killed people and collapsed buildings. I can't really imagine the force. It was enough to shift the Earth's axis, no kidding. It all goes to demonstrate a profound truth that we often forget. We're really not in control of anything much. It's all in God's hands. While we all know this at some level, we mostly ignore the fact that we are never truly standing on firm ground. It's just through the grace of God, what we call chen in Hebrew, that we exist at all. It's notable in the Torah that when God gives the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, the very ground shakes. You know, an earthquake. A reminder that we all depend on God. In last week's Torah portion of Ki Tisa, Moses asked God to see God's face. And God responded, "You cannot see my face and live." Whatever we think of God's anthropomorphic qualities, no wonder. God is just a great deal more powerful than we can grasp. And what we need to remember is that all we really control is our own actions. Which means that we should try to help the quake survivors in Chile and Haiti. The American Jewish World Service is my favorite for Haiti and the Joint Distribution Committee for Chile, by the way. And we can try to make our lives worthwhile by good and caring action. That is, the ground on which we stand may not be as solid as we think, but we can still, by our deeds, seek to make it holy ground. And so, we can make things good. David Broza was a rising young singer-guitarist without a record contract back in 1977 when he and Israeli poet Yonatan Geffen wrote a song together. They called it Yiyeh Tov, roughly, "It'll be good." Egyptian President Anwar Sadat arrived for peace negotiations with Israel immediately thereafter, leading to the Camp David Accords, and that song exactly captured the mood of Israel, becoming an overnight sensation and a huge hit, and starting David Broza on what became an international career as a singer-songwriter. Here's that first big hit of his, Yiyeh Tov, "It'll Be Good." וזה עושה לי די עצוב. האביב חלף עבר לו, מי יודע אם ישוב. הליצן היה למלך, הנביא נהיה ליצן, ושכחתי את הדרך. אבל אני עוד כאן, ויהיה טוב, יהיה טוב, כן. לפעמים אני נשבר, אז הלילה רובו, הלילה איתה. ילדים לובשים כנפיים ועפים אל הצבא, ואחרי שנתיים הם חוזרים ללא תשובה. אנשים חיים במתח, מחפשים סיבה לנשום, ואין שנאה לרצח, מדברים השלום. ויהיה טוב, יהיה טוב, כן. לפעמים אני נשבר, אז הלילה רובו, הלילה איתך. That was Yiyeh Tov by our guest this morning, David Broza. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few minutes, we'll meet him, the legendary Israeli world music singer, songwriter, and guitarist. David Broza's here in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Arizona's first Jewish congregation celebrates a century. On March 20th, 2010, Temple Emmanuel turns 100, celebrating a century as the leader of Judaism in Arizona. Temple Emmanuel, the first Jewish congregation in Arizona, celebrates its 100th anniversary with a festive gala Saturday night, March 20th at 6 p.m. at the Hilton El Conquistador Resort. This centennial celebration will honor all of Temple's past presidents and Joan and Donald Diamond for their vision, leadership, and the dedication they have provided over these 100 years. This sparkling, historic occasion, Emmanuel was founded 2 years before Arizona achieved statehood, will feature dinner, live music and dancing, and a multimedia program with tales from the temple's remarkable history and dynamic present. All are invited to this once-in-a-century event. For more information on attending, offering a tribute, and supporting this historic evening, contact Jill Rich at jbr@dakotacom.net or call 520-349-0174. That's 349-0174. Or call Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
Passover is coming up fast, so why is this night different from all other nights? Because you can spend it with Rabbi Sam Kohan, enjoying a Seder in a way that makes Passover live and breathe as never before for every age. And this year, it's part of the 100th anniversary of Temple Emmanuel, which makes this an even more extraordinary night. To truly experience this great festival of freedom, join Rabbi Sam Kohan for a second night Passover Seder that's simply the finest in Southern Arizona. This celebration is on Tuesday night, March 30th at 6 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Reservations are a must. Call 520-327-4501. The food is great and kosher, but it's the stories, songs, and spirit of Rabbi Kohan that'll make this a Seder you'll never forget. Learn, enjoy, laugh, cry, and eat well. Call 327-4501 to make your reservation now for Tuesday, March 30th, a memorable second night of Passover with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Or if you live on the northwest side of Tucson, there will also be a second night Seder in the northwest with Rabbi Ben Sharp. Call 327-4501 for more information on how to make this the best Passover ever through Temple Emmanuel.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish Israeli superstar David Broza, who I personally think is the best guitar player I've ever seen up close. Do you think you're the best guitar player?
You're asking me? Oh, no. I'm aspiring. I'm very happy with what I got. I've mastered the instrument, and, you know, the craft and the art is pretty good, but I don't know. I'm always very hard on myself. And, you know, I don't regard myself as a guitarist. I'm more of an accompanist, although I do give it a lot of guitar work while I perform. So it gives the impression that I'm really an instrumentalist.
You know, you really do. I had the privilege of watching you do a sound check one time. You were just fooling around, and I was just amazed. You've had a huge impact in Israel, and you've done so much of your recording in English. You worked in Spain. What's your favorite language to sing in, and what's your favorite kind of music to do?
Well, my language is Hebrew. That's primarily. I wish the entire world would have spoken Hebrew. I wish when they were deciding what language the United States of America should speak in 1776, they would have chosen Hebrew, which they were about to.
If we had only been there and asked, you know?
Exactly. Nobody asked us.
No.
Well, actually, Thomas Jefferson, although they definitely thought Hebrew was the right language because they were all very religious and went by the Bible and the Old Testament. But I'm thinking they didn't do it right for us, so I got to do it right for myself. And so I've been traveling this country for years and years and connecting to the land through American poets. And I've been setting music to poetry for my entire career. So in Israel, it's Israeli poets, and here the American poets, and that way I've, you know, acquired myself, let's say, my own market, my own turf, and I've been doing so for the past 20 years.
When you wrote the song, going back in history, when you wrote the song Yeh Tov, did you think about it as, you know, that it would become a peace anthem?
Well, no. Originally, this was written as a song of the week kind of thing. I was working with Yonatan Geffen, great poet and very phenomenal performer and a controversial writer and actually my closest friend throughout these 35 and so years of my career. We had a show together and he suggested that we write on a weekly basis a song that would deal with a political issue or an emerging issue, and this was the first song, and this was the first week, and this was the first issue, was the landing of an arrival of President Anwar Sadat of Egypt to Israel. And then who knew that this would become an anthem, and who knew that I would actually become a recording artist and take off with this career of mine, which has lasted so long. But that was the first song I'd ever set to music.
It's a great story. We will talk much more with David Broza, the magnificent Israeli singer, songwriter, guitarist, composer, when we come back here on Too Jewish.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
Looking for a unique dining experience with menu selections made from scratch from the freshest ingredients? The Beeline, located at 621 North 4th Avenue, sets a new precedent with high-quality food and beverages in a counter-service setting. This blend has earned the Beeline the Best Casual Dining Award from Tucson Weekly 5 times. From their perfectly spiced mahi fish tacos to their popular pasta dishes featuring vodka, pesto, or traditional Italian red sauce, you are sure to find something perfect for your taste. Try their scrumptious dessert selection, carefully prepared from scratch by their talented pastry chef. Enjoy wines by the glass or bottle, microbrew, craft beers are on tap. The Beeline, 621 North 4th Avenue. Stop by or call 882-7575. Visit their retail location, Time Market on University Boulevard near 4th Ave, with a great selection of over 300 different wines and 100 beers and gourmet foods to go. Call 882-7575 for the Beeline and Time Market. Unique casual dining experiences. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows by contacting us through the website or downloading us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. To keep alive the David Broza theme, here's his wonderful light song, Melach Yam, the Salt Sea.
Kmo shehitchil lanu hayom, yadanu ma holech likrot, amarti shnut ve'at zachak, haya baruch sheyesh mishak. שעמדת בחלוקך כמו שהפשלת את מבטך הרגיש מתוק בעצמות ידענו זה הולך לקרות מלח ים, מלח
We welcome our more or less new correspondent, Rabbi David Wilfond, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Good morning, Gingy.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
Wonderful. Thanks.
Great.
I'm interested in the mood on the street in Israel. How are Israelis feeling about their country right now? I haven't been there in a year, and you know, you can't tell from the news.
So here we are now, March 2010. We're right after Purim. And my sense of the mood is that... I would say overall Israelis feel good, And there's this, but there's a sense that nobody quite knows how things are going to move forward. We're kind of at an impasse. There's been a disillusionment in the last couple of years with the far left. The far left has fallen apart. There's been a disillusionment with the far right. The far right has fallen apart. And we're kind of in what people call, we're in the far center. And it's, you know, what's really been good is that there's a tremendous amount of maturity in how Israelis look at what's going on. The old ideologies have fallen away. Nobody's trying to impose their own fantasy upon what the actual situation is. People are trying to be as brutally honest as possible. Not brutal in terms of how we deal with others, but brutally honest. And there was a sense once that the left was naive and the right was brutal. And Israelis don't want to be either. They don't want to be naive. They don't want to be brutal. And there's really a sense, I would say, that since 2000, which was the failure of Camp David and the Second Intifada, there's a sense that the ball has shifted into the Palestinian court, that they've got to show that they are capable of creating something in the West Bank that can be viable. And Israel's not really ready to move one way or another right now. It's just kind of hanging in there, waiting to see what's going to happen. So that's my sense of the mood. People are confident. People aren't running from the country. The Intifada is basically over. The Intifada was won, but there isn't any kind of a joyousness of we've beat them. Rather, there's a sense of we've learned how to live with this. We've learned how to defend ourselves to it, but we've got to figure out how to help them get out of their ideologies and become more pragmatic about making a better future for both Palestinians and Israelis. Does that summarize for you a little bit?
That's a great snapshot of how Israelis are thinking today. Confident, a little more mature, but not overly optimistic. Wait and see. Let's see how the Palestinians react.
Right. The things we are optimistic about is the economy. Our economy is booming. We're still doing well. We're doing lots of exports and high tech. Our real estate market did not drop. And we've been sort of watching what's going on in America, in Europe, and just sort of hoping that we can withstand the waves of the economic crisis. But our ship is pretty stable, and we have a positive GDP, and hopefully things will continue that way.
Nice to know there's somewhere in the world like that. Thanks, Jin. And particularly nice to know that it's in Israel. Thanks, Gingy. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome. Be well, Sam.
Take care. Bye-bye. We welcome our Mavinta, our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about love and have moved around to sexual ethics. Let's explore some of the various possibilities for primary sexual relationships in the world today. I guess you could call them non-heterosexual relationships, homosexuality, bisexuality,
certainly,
transgender issues.
I'd love to. Well, first, just to be very summary about it, we know that the Torah commands us in two specific places. It prohibits a man from lying with a man as a woman in Leviticus. There is nothing in the Torah, by the way, that prohibits or forbids lesbian relationships. That is only, there are references in the Talmud that it is an indecency, but there's nothing that says a woman shall not lie with a woman, just is a matter of understanding. But I think we have to establish a couple of important things in both classical and then Reform conservative Jewish thinking. Classical Jewish thinking, no matter what we say about homosexuality, it specifically distinguishes that Judaism is concerned with the act and not with the inner feelings, which means in real life, I think, that it is not the homosexual himself who is really seen as to'eva, an abomination. It is the act. And there are many reasons we can assume back in the old days why the act of engaging in homosexuality would be forbidden, the biggest one of which is that it is, you know, the spilling of the seed, not for procreation. So we have that distinction. But, you know, I think that we have to look at where the Jewish thinking has evolved, and it's been pretty remarkable, really beginning with the Reform Movement and as far back as 1977, when, you know, the women's movement was just coming to a fore. The Reform Movement had the, I think, real insight to look at this as a human rights issue, not just limited to sexuality, but as a human rights issue, saying that, you know, everyone deserves to be treated equally within the Jewish tradition. And really, at the forefront of this was the Reform Movement's resolutions that confirmed that homosexuality that homosexuals would be recognized fully as equals in the Jewish community, and that the Reform Movement doesn't discriminate on the basis of gender or sexual orientation. There can be, and there are, many Reform rabbis who are gay or lesbians. They've been admitted into the seminaries for many years, I think probably since the early 90s. They've been admitted into the seminary, maybe even earlier than that.
Yeah, for sure.
And there's commitment ceremonies.
I would say it goes back to the 80s.
Okay.
And undoubtedly, there were some there long before that.
And so
openly
really,
the
Reform Movement led the way in both the commitment ceremonies. Kiddushim can be present. That we have now, thankfully, as of 2006, the conservative movement has accepted homosexual and lesbians into the seminary, so they will, of course, be ordained now, gay and lesbian rabbis. They have permitted, although not mandated, that conservatives synagogue, the rabbis of those conservative synagogues, can determine on their own basis whether or not to have commitment ceremonies. But there's
but
really
that's,
a...
that's fresh and not actually widely accepted yet in the conservative...
Not yet, but it's certainly there on the books.
Yeah, finally it is.
So I think the most important thing for people to understand is that in a period of less than 40 years, Judaism has really acknowledged the pain, the difficulty of what it means, what it would mean to be a gay lesbian and live a life without the joys of intimate partnershiping and intimacy with the same gendered person. And they've really recognized that and embraced both the people and the institutions that support that.
There's even some motion in the Orthodox world, which we can talk about another time. But thanks so much, Amy. We'll talk next week.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We welcome the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Weiler of Janos Restaurant, the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, the best way to find out about the best restaurant and restaurants, I should say, in Southern Arizona is to go to the website. It's www.janos.com. What's on there?
Well, that's what I want to direct people to this morning. On our website, we've got all of our wine dinners. We've got all of our specials. If you go to the website and opt in, we will send you an e-blast every week telling you all of the things that we're doing. We've got all sorts of wine dinners scheduled. We've got music coming up in the summer. We've got just fun menu things that change all the time. We'll let you know every week what's going on. Just go to the website, opt in, and you'll get an e-blast from us.
And cooking classes, too. My wife takes those.
The cooking classes, not to mention the cooking classes.
For really the best restaurant site in all of Arizona, www.janos.com. But people can also call you, can't they?
Just give us a call, 615-6100.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Arizona's first Jewish congregation celebrates a century. On March 20th, 2010, Temple Emmanuel turns 100. celebrating a century as the leader of Judaism in Arizona. Temple Emmanuel, the first Jewish congregation in Arizona, celebrates its 100th anniversary with a festive gala Saturday night, March 20th at 6 p.m. at the Hilton El Conquistador Resort. The centennial celebration will honor all of Temple's past presidents and Joan and Donald Diamond for their vision, leadership, and the dedication they have provided over these 100 years. This sparkling, historic occasion, Emmanuel was founded 2 years before Arizona achieved statehood, will feature dinner, live music and dancing, and a multimedia program with tales from the Temple's remarkable history and dynamic present. All are invited to this once-in-a-century event. For more information on attending, offering a tribute, and supporting this historic evening, contact Jill Rich at jbr@dakotacom.net or call 520-349-0174. That's 349-0174. Or call Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been exploring various boundaries and borders in Judaism, and you brought up the question at the end of our talk last week about the idea of separation as a form of holiness. The word in Hebrew for holiness, kadosh, is closely associated with the word hekdesh, which just means setting aside something that's otherwise ordinary. By setting it aside, we actually make it holy. For example, setting aside something for the priests in the days of the temple, a portion of something that's going to be special.
Right. And everybody's favorite service of the week, because it's the shortest one, is Havdalah, which ends Shabbat and marks the boundary between Shabbat and the rest of the week, ordinary days. And Havdalah just means to separate.
Right.
The separation.
Well, Havdil.
Right. So there's a lot of that in Jewish history. And what's interesting is, among other things, in Islamic history, the concept of borders and separations is also very important. I mean, not only in terms of dietary laws, which are in some ways very similar to ours, but also in terms of the early expansion of the Arabs from their own peninsula into an almost worldwide empire that stretched from Western China to Spain and from, you know, southern France to Yemen and to places that are now known as Karachi and Hyderabad. When they built that empire, they set up administrative centers all over, usually in places where there had been no previous city, although in a few cases like Damascus, they used existing cities and they became administrative centers. But these places were called, in plural, Amsar. The singular was Misr. And Misr is the same word that is used in Arabic to denote Egypt.
Right.
And it's the same root as Mitzrayim,
which is the Hebrew word for Egypt.
For Egypt in the Bible, in the story of Passover and the Exodus and all that. And what Misr means actually is a border or a frontier or a frontier province. And in the ancient Arab mind, the land that we call Egypt was the limit of the Arab world. West of that and south of that was Africa. That was the limit. And so the root name for Egypt in both Hebrew and Arabic comes from this notion of border and distinction, which was always important for Muslims. First, in their earliest history, the distinction between Arabs and non-Arabs was of paramount importance. Then of importance was the distinction between Muslims and non-Muslims, and then eventually, of course, the distinction between Shia and Sunni. But this notion of distinction in Judaism is very closely linked with the notion of holiness, and I'm sure you could give us some examples of that. But in Islam, it's more related to a political question of who's with us and who's against us. The distinction of the border is our camp versus their camp.
Ins and outs.
Yeah,
and in Judaism, it's interesting. It's not so much that, but the distinction between the holy and the ordinary, being Kodesh L'chol, as it says in the Havdalah ceremony that you alluded to.
Right.
So, very interesting. And interesting implications for how we look at borders altogether.
How we look at borders and how we look at a lot of commandments that otherwise may not make a lot of sense. And I think we should take a look at some of those specifically when we talk next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
Good.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Yitzchak and Frida go out to see the revival of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway. It's the hottest show of the year and sold out for the run. Through careful planning and a lot of extra cash, they're lucky. They manage to get the best seats in the house. But they notice there's an empty seat in the row right behind them. Intermission comes, and no one is in that seat. Frida turns to the woman sitting next to the empty seat and says, "Pardon me, madam, but as this is such a sold-out show and in such demand, we were wondering why that seat is empty." The woman says, "That's my late husband's seat." Frida's horrified and apologizes for being so insensitive. But a few minutes later, she turns around and says, "Without meaning to be rude or anything, this is an incredibly tough show to get into. Surely you must have a friend or relative who would have wanted to come and see the show." The woman nods and says, "Yes, but they're all at the Shiva." See, the Shiva is the memorial service after the funeral at the house, and you get the idea. Anyway, that was the old Jewish Joke of the Week special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. We now welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. This is the rather spooky story collected by Howard Schwartz, and it comes originally from Worms from Germany. Once there was this young man who was just a good-for-nothing young man. All he cared about was the inheritance from his mother, and she knew this, and she made a point of hiding it from him, so that when she passed away, he did everything he could to find it in the house without success. And so he approached an old witch and asked her for her assistance, promising her half of the inheritance if she succeeded. And so she went back to her house, and she said a number of spells over a dagger, and that night as she went to sleep, she slipped the dagger under a pillow. And in her dreams, a demon came to her with a knife, the same one, embedded in his chest, and he begged her to take it out, and she said, "No, bring me an old woman who has passed away recently, and only then will I remove this knife." When she woke up, she felt under her pillow, and sure enough, there was no knife there. And the next night she lay down and went to sleep, and that same old demon came to her with the knife still in his chest, much weaker now, and his son was with him. And the demon's son said, "Please, please take the knife from my father's chest." And the witch said, "No, you know my conditions. Bring that woman." And with that she woke up, and again she felt under her pillow, and there was no knife there. And on the third night, that old demon and his son came with an older woman. And the old woman said, "What am I doing here?" And the witch said, "I want to know where you hid your inheritance." And at first the woman refused to tell her, but then the young demon begged on behalf of his father, who was on the verge of death, and the older woman, she agreed. And she told the witch, "Tell my good-for-nothing son that the inheritance is hidden in a tea can, and that's all I will say." And so the witch said a couple of spells under her breath, and when she woke up, she felt under her pillow, and the dagger was back again. And so she went to the house of that young man, and she told him what the words of his mother had been. And the young man said, "Oh, that's no good. I've searched in all the tea cans." And he slammed the door in the witch's face. And he was thinking, well, maybe one of them had a fake bottom. And he felt around, and sure enough, there was one tea can where the bottom was a little bit more shallow than it seemed like it would be from the outside. And so he pried it open, and sure enough, in the bottom, there was this wad of cash. And he was so happy. But then he thought about the witch, how she would be demanding for half of it, and he wasn't willing to give her that, not for the little help she had given. And so quickly he packed all of his things, he took that wad of cash, and he left town, intending it to be forever. Well, the witch, she waited for her payment, and when no payment came, she sought it out, and when she found that that young man had fled town, she didn't get too upset. She just went back to her house. She took a knife from the shelf. She said a few spells over it. And with a grin on her lips, she lay her head down on the pillow, and she slipped the knife underneath.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week's double Torah portion of Vayakhel Pkudei, the conclusion of the book of Exodus, deals with the creation and completion of the tabernacle in the wilderness, consecration of the first central worship sanctuary for the people of Israel. Vayakhel et ha'am, the text has it, Moses assembled the people, called them together, and asked them on God's behalf to bring forward the finest objects they possess to help create a tabernacle in which the entire people could worship God in holiness. And the people gave the best they had, gold and silver, precious stones and materials used to create a beautiful sanctuary, one they could be proud of, and one they believed would lend itself to the perpetuation of beauty and sanctity. And then Moses invited those artisans, wise in the ways of working with beautiful items, to come forward and create a structure that embodied what God saw as appropriate for a sanctuary. In particular, Moses explained that God has called by name a man named Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, whom God filled with the Spirit of the Lord in wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and all manner of skilled workmanship. He is filled with the wisdom of the heart that he might teach and work with every wise-hearted person in this sacred work. When the work was complete, they had created a tabernacle into which God immediately brought the divine presence, the Shekhinah, a place of profound sacredness for our ancestors. I love the phrase for those skilled in the work of the hands, wise-hearted men and women, wise-hearted, who can create beauty and elegance and so serve God in this world. Each of us, every one of us, has different skills. Some can sing, some dance, some speak eloquently, some do radio shows. And some of us create works of art and practical beauty with our hands. Each of us contributes to the creation of holiness in this world by applying those skills to holy work. And when we do, we too have the potential to bring God's presence into our midst, into our ordinary practical world, and so make it sacred. May we each use our own skills this week and every week to make our lives and our world a little holier. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and hear from singer, songwriter, great guitarist David Broza. All that on Two Jewish when we come back.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Dubai police will seek the arrest of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the head of the Mossad over the assassination of the top Hamas official killed there recently. Dubai Police Chief Dahi Khalfan Tamim said he will ask Dubai's prosecutor to issue an arrest warrant for Netanyahu and Mayor Dagan, Al Jazeera reported. Tamim told a television news channel that he is almost certain that Israel's Mossad was involved in the murder of Mahmoud al-Mabouh in a Dubai hotel room in January. Israel has neither confirmed nor denied its involvement. I am now completely sure it was the Mossad, the French news agency quoted him as saying. Al Jazeera also reported, citing the United Arab Emirates newspaper The National, that Dubai has asked the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, to investigate the prepaid credit cards used by some of the 27 alleged assassins. They were issued by a U.S.-based Meta Financial Group's MetaBank. Apparently Hamas is trying to pretend that it was Fatah that killed this Hamas assassin, but you know what? I'm pretty sure it was the Mossad. In other news, Hank Rosenstein, who played for a mostly Jewish New York Knicks team that took part in what is considered the NBA's first game back in 1946, has passed away. In those days, basketball was a Jewish sport. Rosenstein, a member of the National Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, died in Boca Raton, Florida, of heart failure. He was 89 years old. Rosenstein was 6'4". He played in the front court in those days, a forward, one of eight Jewish Knickerbockers when they played the Toronto Huskies in Toronto, November 1, 1946, the debut of the new Basketball Association of America. Rosenstein scored 5 points. The Knicks won the game 68-66. The BAA merged with the National Basketball League in 1949 to form the NBA, the National Basketball Association. The NBA considers the Knicks-Huskies game that Rosenstein played in its very first. He was traded to the Providence Steamrollers, then helped the Scranton Miners to championships in 49-50 and 50-51. In his best year, he led the team, scoring an average of nearly 12 points a game back when they didn't score much. Rosenstein also starred at Boys High School in Brooklyn and City College of New York. He was inducted to the Jewish Hall of Fame in 1998 and the New York City Basketball Hall of Fame in 2007. A nice reminder of when basketball was Jewish. May he rest in peace. Last week, the New York Yankees settled one fight in order to book another. The Bronx Bombers announced they had reached an agreement with Jonathan Ballon, whose son Scott is scheduled to have his bar mitzvah at Yankee Stadium on June 5th. Same day, the Yankees want to host a boxing match between Miguel Cotto and Yuri Foreman, a former Two Jewish guest. The bar mitzvah would have included use of the scoreboard for 30 minutes and thus would have interfered with a fight. The Yankees did not specify what changes were worked out, but they thanked the Ballon family for graciousness, understanding, and goodwill, apologizing for any inconvenience. Ballon, the lead bond lawyer for the financing of Yankee Stadium, did not comment. The Yankees now must complete a deal with the boxing promoter Bob Arum, who wants to move the fight from Madison Square Garden to Yankee Stadium in order to get more fans in. Arum, who is also Jewish, promised the Ballon party tickets to the fight and a pre-bout meet and greet between Scott Ballon and Yuri Foreman, the WBA's 154-pound champion, only Jewish champion these days. Foreman himself is studying to become a rabbi. This fight will apparently take place at 11:30 at night so that Foreman's observant fans can travel from Brooklyn to see him fight after Shabbos in June, when days are long. Now that's a Jewish story. And that's also the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back our guest this morning, Israeli superstar David Broza, one of the most dynamic and vibrant and now enduring performers in the singer-songwriter world. Charismatic and energetic, he's performed all around the world. David, you have been working with so many different people. You've collaborated with so many different people, Paul Simon, Al DiMeola, Bob Dylan, Spyro Gyra, Van Morrison, Sting. Who are your favorite people that you've worked with?
Wow, each and every one of them, you know, and they all came at a different moment in my career, and I've kept in touch with most of them, but I move on, as I have done, and my most recent collaboration has been really an amazing one with an American guitarist, the Guitar Hero, who a lot of people might know and some might not remember. His name is G.E. Smith, and G.E. Was one of the first members of Hall & Oates and was the musical director for Saturday Night Live for many, many years, and played with Bob Dylan for years and a lot of other real great bands. And he's been my kind of partner and right hand in my last couple of years on my projects, and this has been great fun. Other than him, I've had my performances and works that I do with my Palestinian musicians in East Jerusalem, which is really beyond excitement. It has levels of gratification which are very, very deep and personal.
So talk about, that was Sabrine. Tell us about how that project originated and what kinds of stuff have come out of it, what kinds of events have come out of it.
Well, I've always worked on the social aspect of life in the Middle East. I've always been involved and worked on civil movements and projects that have to do with tolerance and coexistence, although I never really worked on making music together with Arabs or Palestinians. And a friend of mine suggested about 12 years ago that I should meet with Sabrine, with Saeed Murad, actually, the leader of this great Palestinian group, who are the official group of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Gaza. And so we met. And actually, our meeting was more on a social basis, and it remained that way for several years. And then at some point, somewhere during the Intifada, the second Intifada, around 2002, I thought, you know, enough of all this drinking coffee and hanging out and having a good time. Let's do some music. And they have a beautiful studio, which I love, in East Jerusalem. And while we were sitting there, I pulled out my guitar one day and I said to Saeed, let's just write some music together. And this is where it started. I wrote something, ended it at you know, at the end of the stanza, I kind of ended it, and I said, why don't you take over and start here? And we created this routine of co-writing melodies, and that's basically what brought us really together as one. And we, our first and real only major recording that we published is called Belibi, In My Heart, which we put on my last, which was a third Spanish album, Parking Completo, and it's an additional track that we did as a token of our friendship and musicianship.
And you had a couple of kids' choirs on that cut too, on Belibi.
Sure, yeah, beautiful. That was actually one of the most moving moments, because we had Palestinian kids singing, some from the refugee camps from Shawfat, and some just from East Jerusalem. And then came the Jewish kids, who were mostly religious kids, with their parents, and they agreed to come to East Jerusalem to the studio. That was really a moving moment when you come and say, you know, if it hadn't been for the music, I doubt if these kids would have ever shared a time with with each other. And it was beautiful. They just mingled and sang and talked and laughed. It was just so beautiful. And the parents were amazing. You know, I was reluctant whether they would, afraid that they would drag me into a conversation where they would feel that I'm dragging them or putting them in a situations that are not wanted and are too dangerous, and which I don't believe so. And I was wrong. They were just so giving and let themselves be and relaxed and beautiful. And hence the beautiful recording, which was monumental when we released it, because we released it simultaneously on the Palestinian broadcasting radio station, and simultaneously with Israeli, actually the IDF station, which is the most listened to in the Middle East, but also as a symbol of the IDF, it's the least you'd expect to have a common release hour of a song that was sung by Israeli and Palestinians. And so it was beautiful. That just shows you music can go a long way.
I was talking to an Israeli musician not too long ago, and they said a gold record in Israel is like 50,000 copies.
20,000
copies, I'm sorry. Yeah. A gold record in America is a few more copies than that.
Half a million, yeah.
Yeah. Does it feel just as successful to have a gold record in America as in Israel, do you think?
Oh, no. I mean, commercially, absolutely, there's no comparison.
Of course.
But emotionally, I think Israel is fantastic. I mean, if you get the success, that level, I mean, gold is relatively good, platinum is better, and
double platinum is better still. And
so, but you know what? That's not even what matters. I think artists, if they last a career and not just a one album thing, and that's not something given. It's very, there's very few, and as you know, it's very difficult to make a living just from art. And those of us who do, I feel, I'm very, very fortunate that we can do it every day, day in and day out. So there's not that many. And in Israel, it's wonderful how the audience embraces the artist and everybody becomes one.
It's a beautiful sentiment. Artists who the audiences continue to embrace all around the world. Thank you, David Broza, for a great visit here on Too Jewish. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
Passover is coming up fast, so why is this night different from all other nights? Because you can spend it with Rabbi Sam Kohan, enjoying a Seder in a way that makes Passover live and breathe as never before for every age. And this year, it's part of the 100th anniversary of Temple Emmanuel, which makes this an even more extraordinary night. To truly experience this great festival of freedom, join Rabbi Sam Kohan for a second night Passover Seder that's simply the finest in Southern Arizona. This celebration is on Tuesday night, March 30th at 6 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Reservations are a must. Call 520-327-4501. The food is great and kosher, but it's the stories, songs, and spirit of Rabbi Kohan that'll make this a Seder you'll never forget. Learn, enjoy, laugh,
cry, and eat well. Call 327-4501 to make your reservation now for Tuesday, March 30th, a memorable second night of Passover with Rabbi Sam Cohan. Or if you live on the northwest side of Tucson, there will also be a second night Seder in the northwest with Rabbi Ben Sharp. Call 327-4501 for more information on how to make this the best Passover ever through Temple Emmanuel.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Next week, our guest will be Dr. Richard Ablin, creator of the prostate screening exam that is used universally now, explaining why we don't need to do most of the testing and a lot of the treatment we do for prostate cancer. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from whom else? David Broza, our guest today, who will be here in Tucson at the Fox Theater on March 13th. Get your tickets now. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week. We pray of peace.
Od nilman lichyot beyachad Ein chursot tatsei zeiti Yeladim ichyu
bli. The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.